Therefore, there was a great deal of self-educated Quakers in these days. And where there was a group of friends together, they would join together and have what they would call a literary club or a club of natural history. These little community clubs, sometimes limited to friends and sometimes including others, but mostly with some important Quaker nucleus. Another thing that they could do was to establish libraries. Before any public libraries, there were private libraries and subscription libraries and meeting libraries. Now, of course, a meeting library wouldn't have everything in it. You know what it would have as a nucleus, like the Haverford Library. I've already shown you volumes 1, 2, 3, and 4 of the Haverford Library. They had these great folios of George Fox's Journal and Sewell's History of the Quakers and Robert Barclay's Apology. And those would be in the Quaker Library, but they would ultimately branch out. And the largest and best private library in America in the colonial period was owned by James Logan here in Philadelphia, and is the nucleus of a large section of the Philadelphia Public Library. Another thing they did, beside these little local clubs, they founded national organizations. The American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia is the oldest learned society in America. And it was founded by Benjamin Franklin. And next on the list is John Barker and other Quakers in this Quaker settlement. What is it? The American Philosophical Society for the Promotion of Useful Knowledge, founded in Philadelphia. That's the official name. And is still a very respectable group in this community. In England, the oldest and most famous learned society is the Royal Society. Founded in 1661, very soon including William Penn as a member, and later, some of these physicians in England I've spoken of, like Dr. John Fothergill, Dr. Lettson, and having as corresponding members some of the Quaker scientists in the society. But many of the early proceedings of that society have articles about, articles on experiments in electricity by Benjamin Franklin, and other articles on electricity by and Franklin's Quaker neighbors here in Philadelphia. The Royal Society is, perhaps it puts on too much airs. It takes a good deal of pride in being the oldest learned society in the English-speaking world. Met in London and has continued recruit Quaker members. I got the April 19th issue of the London Friend, a weekly paper published in London, and it tells of the recent appointment of another Quaker to the society. Going back over the years, if you make a list of the Quakers who are members of the society, someone discovered some years ago that if you were a Quaker in England, you had 46 times better chance being elected to the Royal Society than if you weren't. That is, there is a certain disproportion of Quakers in the membership of this society. Two of the papers written this the last few weeks were on John Dalton and on author Stanley Eddington, the astrophysicist. They're both members of the Royal Society in their day. Well, this exposure and interest, I might say, much more in science than in other activities, perhaps. Belles Lettres, for instance, was not an area which could be too congenial to friends. These libraries didn't have Shakespeare, and they didn't have fiction. And until quite recent times, some French schools taught neither drama or fiction. I remember visiting a friend's school some years ago, and there wasn't a single book in the library There wasn't any Shakespeare, there wasn't any fiction, either of them. There were interesting books and modern books, but there were none of these. This prejudice, as you know, is I think not very influential now. I shouldn't be surprised the Quaker colleges had more and more students studying English, science, or English and other foreign literatures with all concludes. But of course, reading was an occupation that a conscientious friend could do if he chose the right things. And it wasn't always too dull. There was even some poetry that you could read. Not drama, of course, but Cowper, and Young, and other ancient poets of that time, you could read with pleasure. There was some aesthetic appreciation. A week ago, Saturday, the students of American culture in the Middle Atlantic states, the professors, had a meeting here on this campus, it happened, studying the aesthetic element in Quakers. And one was on Quaker art, and one was on Quaker architecture, and one was on Quaker prose style. So that there was some material, you see, of a cultural character. It was a chapter in their general study, year by year, of this group of professors of American culture, of phases, contributory phases in the complex culture of America. Cultural expansion and liberalizing of Quakerism has taken place over the past years, not without some difficulties and not without some advantages. There was a lot of prejudice to be overcome. And I'll mention some of the conflict. Science, for example. Science was felt 100 years ago to be hostile to religion. There's a great book written by the president of Cornell on the conflict of science and religion, showing how one area after another, the two seem to be incompatible. I haven't read that whole great work, two-volume work of Andrew D. White, but I have looked at the chapters that deal with archaeology and religion. Well, obviously, a lot of the exploration Bible lands then and since then has thrown doubt on the inerrancy of the Bible. You don't find that what you discover always agree. You don't find the walls of Jericho lying flat. The Bible says they were flat, but there's no real evidence in excavation that event took place, just as described. And then, of course, the study of biology and of evolution. All through America, conservative religion has been fighting against evolution. One of the most interesting things about the Pope's encyclical issued last month was that he used the word evolution a good many times. Not, however, I guess, in the natural science sense. Well, there was the problem of literary study of the Bible. Naturally, I'm interested in that aspect. The literary study of the Bible, done scientifically, the way you'd study any other piece of literature, doesn't agree with some of the claims made about the Bible, made for it, perhaps not in it, that other people are maintaining. And the result is that all through Christendom, in the last half of the last century, there was the conflict of science and religion. Now, friends, I think, on the whole, fared better than most other groups that might be compared. Because, as you know, the standard of the Bible's truth and authority was never the principal rule of Quakerism. And the fact that they sat loose to the Bible enabled them to adjust to the apparent contradictions to the Bible either in literary criticism or in science, evolutionary science of the creation of the world, or even in astronomy. You see, the world's gone through a tremendous revolution in which our Earth was the center of things, and man was the supreme object of a six-day process of creation. Well, all those things are hardly taken literally today. So in this respect, Quakerism had the same problem to face. And I think that, I think they were at an advantage in that they were not as wed to the infallibility of the Bible. At least most of them were not. The extreme evangelical wing was, but many of them were able to liberalize their religion to fit science. Furthermore, there's something about science that's very congenial to an aspect of Quakerism, namely the experimental character of it. It was depending not on dogma, and science had just as much dogma as religion ever had. And the dogmas of science have been gone in the way of the dogmas of religion. And the Quakers already were free from the dogmas of religion and depended on experience rather than on authority and tradition. And therefore, in their experimental approach to the natural world, as botanists or chemists or whatnot, they were in a favorable position, I should say. Of course, their position on some social questions, like slavery and war, was regarded by educated people as unrealistic. And there they had some convincing to do. And also their attitude on prisoners and criminals. And therefore, it's natural that in our time, more recent time, that friends should undertake to interpret Quakerism in terms satisfactory to the educated world, and not merely in terms satisfactory to their own inner group or their own tradition. And there have been some spokesmen of Quakerism that have done so in various fields. Arthur Stanley Edison, Eddington, another British scientist I know, wrote quite a lot about Quakerism and natural science. And other people have been interested in Quakerism and modern religious questions, and you know the names of some of the spokesmen of that, Elton Trueblood, and that was Steer, still living and teaching, and before that, Tom Kelly, former teacher here, and Rufus Jones, former teacher here. These are men that have attempted to interpret Quakerism to a cultured world, and to do it with a mastery themselves of cultural knowledge and cultural reading. incidentally, they have attempted to explain the history of Quakerism and to explain it not only to the public but to their own society. I put on the board the names of four books in a series. You've seen one of these books, I think, in your reading, but there are four books taking the history of Quakerism from the very beginning down to 1920. Two of them written by Rufus Jones and two of them written by William Charles Braithwaite, a finely, again, it's a late performance. He's not a trained historian, but he does as well as a trained historian. He was by professional lawyer. So that those books and the two that Rufus wrote on the history of mysticism before it have become a standard history. Other denominations have claimed that no denomination has had its history so well written up as the Society of Friends. And they often add, and they least deserve it. This at least is the envious view of this series. It was really a fine undertaking. A good deal of the credit for it rests with two men, Rufus Jones, who was teacher here for 41 years, and John William Rowntree in England, a member of the Rowntree family over there. And before about 1900, these two men got together and planned this history. Roundtree unfortunately died in 1905, quite young. And as you go to the meeting house up here, you'll see that his grave, he died in this country. His grave is next to that of Regis Jones up by the meeting house. These two men about that time put their heads together, see what they could do to put Quakerism on the map as a respectable religious movement. And they did something also for Quakerism itself, beside writing a history that the public could read and which would interpret Quakerism to its own members. Quakerism has depended for its religious survival not on the professional clergy. And therefore, it depends on an intelligent laity in the Society of Friends. About 1900, English Friends, under the leadership of John Wilhelm Roundtree, decided that they'd have to do some lay education in religion. Up to that time, you know, Quakers were so afraid of teaching anything about religion for fear that what they said about religion might interfere with the Spirit of God telling what was what in religion, that they wouldn't do anything about it. These people got over that fear and established a set of summer schools in which each summer they had lectures, friends and many non-friends, on modern study of religion. And these summer schools brought, if they could in the holiday time, a great many people for a short course in religion. And then they bethought of the idea of having established a graduate school for religion, for religious and social concerns. And in 1903, at Woodbrook, a private home near Birmingham was started, a Woodbrook School of Social Studies, Religious and Social Studies, and is having this summer the 60th anniversary of its founding. And a similar institution has attempted to take an equivalent part in America, perhaps I say a succession of them, of which the present representative is a little school at Wallingford called Pendle Hill. These two institutions, this more recent one and the older one, operate on the theory that adult Quakers need to have a chance to deepen their understanding of spiritual history and of religious life and of social questions so closely connected in Quakerism with their religious beliefs. So this has been a venture in lay education. Of course, if you have a professional ministry, you're not so much interested in that. But much of Quakerism is not. And therefore, you have to have a higher level of the laity to make up for the absence of a few experts on whom everybody depends. Before this phase, John Whittier, in his poetry, which was widely read, was an interpreter of Quakerism to the general public. And I think I may say that in addition to the theoretical explanation of Quakerism, the practical exemplification of Quakerism in recent years, has had a similar effect. I should be speaking of that later in dealing with the history, recent history of the American Friends Service. Next time, I hope to say something about the history of Haverford College.
The quiz Friday.
Yes, now see, I have a lunch, because I have one.